Poi così.
Del Tony Renré, PMG, good morning, can we start at, I think exactly 1 minute after 10, you're supposed to start exactly at 10, I will ask members to introduce themselves, and then parliamentary staff, department. My name is Mandla Khai, Chairperson of Select Committee on Economic and Business Development.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Eddie Mapue and I represent the province of Gauteng.
My name is Wosima Gwebu from the Eastern Cape.
So Honourable Tebe, do you know where he is now? Can we then start with the parliamentary staff?
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Nosipiwo Dinizulu, the committee secretary. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Luthu Masishu, the content advisor for the committee.
Good morning. My name is Belen Mosha. I'm the researcher for the committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rupert Mtilemi. I'm a parliamentary official.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Thabang Mulusi from the Office of the House Chairperson.
Good morning. My name is Mungana Tau. I'm Unit Manager for Finance and Economic Cluster.
Okay, can we go to the department, EDD?
Hi, good morning. Irshad Katrada, advisor to Mr. Patel.
Morning, Tsolofelo Mushi, parliamentary officer to Mr. Patel.
Thank you very much. PMG?
Good morning, everybody. Ismail Hussain, PMG.
Can you introduce yourself when you start with the meeting? There's a gentleman over there. Can you introduce yourself, please?
It's Andrew Barnes from the telecom sector.
Thank you very much. let me indicate that in terms of the program, there are some changes on the members. For day, I was just informed this morning by the committee secretary that there are people that are no longer coming to present. Originally, the program that was sent to me, Dr. Mazwai, was supposed to be the first to present. I've just received a report that he's bereaved, so he's no longer going to present. But there will be responses to the submission that they made. And we also been just told that OD Strado from Knowledge Consulting Competition Practice Group is also not coming. Something came up at her workplace, so she's no longer coming. But there will be responses to her presentation as well as deliberation by members. So, meaning that we were going to start at 11, or 10 past 11, with Mr. Paul Kotsie, Law Society of South Africa. But then I phoned the COSATU and they persuaded them to come earlier than originally scheduled. We thank them very much for agreeing. I'm told that initially they were after one, after lunch, They were persuaded to come before lunch, and they agreed now again this morning to persuade them to come first because of a pullout by the two submitters. Thank you very much, Comrade Tony, for agreeing to these last minute changes. Without wasting time, we will allow you to then make the presentation.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair, and good morning to everybody in the House. Before we go through the handout that was circulated to members earlier today or before this meeting, we'd like to make some comments by way of introduction. The first point, then, that's the most important for COSATU is that we wanted to be absolutely clear that we support the Competition Amendment Bill, and we look forward to this committee speedily processing the bill so that we can start intervening in the economy and undoing many of the practices that have their origins in apartheid, but that continues and thrives today with the huge detriment to our people and to the economy. We must say that we've had extensive discussions at NEDLAC, as is prescribed in the law, that included the minister and all of the representatives from the social partners. So business, labor, and government over a series of meetings had engaged on these matters. We're concerned that at the last minute, the business sector effectively distanced themselves from the report of that discussion. And we make this point because we want our comrades and friends and like-minded people in the committee to be aware that these issues are about powerful vested interests. They are those in the economy who would like it to continue as it has taken place under apartheid and as it continues even today, where they make exorbitant profits and we're not responding to the challenges of our people. So it's clear that we have to find a way to fast-track our interventions, and we have to be mindful of those who never align themselves to the interest of the majority of South Africans. This includes large sections of business and, of course, sections of those members who are present as part of our parliamentary processes but who come here to defend old vested interests. We certainly hope that this bill will undo the concentration in the economy by the old white boys club who are not only maintaining the ill-gotten gain of apartheid but are keeping black players out of the economy by the domination and the dominating factors that they put in place. Not only does this have a huge impediment for transformation in South Africa, but it also has an impediment on our ability to attract investments, because those sections of the economy that are dominated by existing businesses who had come about through the historical developments of apartheid, they continue to manage the economy in such a way that they prohibit the entry of small players, and they also have a detrimental effect on foreign investors coming to invest in our country because of the stumbling blocks for making intervention. We finally support the public interest areas of the bill by way of introduction, because that sends an important signal that was reaffirmed in many of the most recent instances of mergers, whether it's Walmart, Coca-Cola, InBev, or SA Breweries. We've seen significant agreements that have intervened to deconcentrate those sections of the economy and also develop the value chains that created employment for black entrepreneurs and the transformation in the economy in those sectors. We believe that that's an important initiative. Likewise is the concentration on employment and our ability to deal and respond to that. We want to remind the committee that the economic developments in South Africa has not been driven by any great sense of morality. If we just look at the most recent cases of collusion that we've seen, whether this is on matters related to the collusion of bread prices, which essentially stole money from poor people, the collusion around chicken as a key source of protein for poorer communities, and then in the construction of the stadiums as another example, we've seen how those companies have colluded between themselves. What this tells us is that there's clearly a practice in the economy that has its roots in apartheid but that flourished in the democratic dispensation. And what we've got to do now is to make sure that we deal with the instances where that corruption continues to undermine our interests going forward. The question about the attitude of business towards this legislation and the participation in the discussion so far in the institutionalized processes allowed by the government, would no doubt be apparent both to our members of parliament as well as the organizations that represent our people as the electorate in this August House. And so, Chair, before going on to the PowerPoint presentation, we just want to make it absolutely clear that we would urge the NCOP and the Select Committee to look at passing the bill speedily so that we can start intervening in the desperately needed transformation of the economy. Drawing your attention to the presentation that was circulated amongst yourselves, which is titled Kusatu Presentation on the Competition Amendment Bill, November 2018. As I pointed out earlier in respect of the NEDLAC process, we've been involved since December 2017. All of the labor federations that are recognized as NEDLAC have been part of these discussions, as well as all of the business constituencies. And I've given you some flavor of what had come out of those discussions in respect of the attitude of the business constituencies. Our reports today and our support for the provisions that's before this House has not been our initial positions. In starting these discussions, we had much more ambitions, but through the process of engagements, which is a cornerstone of our democracy, we've been able to find agreement on some of the areas and find an appropriate balance that we feel represents both the interest of our members, our workers, the society more broadly, and how it's able to interact with the economy and direct many of the developments. Now, those agreements are captured in the bill before you, and we hope that they will continue to be supported by the government. We want to raise a point that may sit difficultly with the committee. We've been very concerned that many of the members of this House has taken up share ownership in many of the big companies that dominate the economy. And we want to remind them that their primary responsibility here is to advance the interests of our people as a whole, but more especially those people who have voted for the party that the majority represents. Unless we are able to significantly respond to the challenges of unemployment and poverty within our economy, the society is going to implode in all of us. And these steps that are contained in this law make a significant contribution to that response. We'd be really concerned if those who have aligned themselves both as shareholders and as board representatives to some of the big companies that don't want to see transformation act as an impediment to the passing of this bill, that this would significantly undermine the democratic process. We know that some in the House unapologetically speak for business, and no doubt their roots are in those business establishments who oppose this bill, and so we don't expect any more from them. We don't expect any moral direction from them. But certainly from the majority party, we hope that the values that our organization stands for and the liberation promises that it made to our people in the Freedom Charter and the Reconstruction and Development Program, which is advanced by this legislation, that is supported as we go forward. I try to speak to why there'll be attacks on the bill, and in part it is because there are these vested interests, and the vested interest is born out of, in part, the sad history of our country. Apartheid was not only a circumstance where black and white people didn't like each other on the basis of the color of their skin. Apartheid was essentially a system of accumulation. It was the first state capture in our country where people used the state, white people used the state to enrich those elites and the political construct that they put about as a consequence thereof. So we must accept that. And we must undo that as we respond to the challenges and the law that is going to present to help us contribute to that. And so we're not surprised that the business constituency was not forthcoming in these engagements, because what they'd like is to give us the vote every 5 years, but not significantly deal with questions of social justice, which is an absolutely imperative area that requires to be advanced in our society. The clearest indication for all of us in South Africa must be what is contained in the President's State of the Nation address. The direction of our economic transformation, economic growth and development must be questioned when we see that there is deepening levels of unemployment, deepening levels of poverty, and the greatest indicator of the failure of our policy positions is that the levels of inequality today is worse than it was in 1994. Now, the democratic state can't have a more unequal society than the state of apartheid did, who consciously discriminated and exploited large sections of our community. So that's a matter that we hope is central to the considerations by this committee in how we're going to be able to respond to these questions. Moving on to how will workers benefit from these new sections of the law that's put before you. We're very grateful that the section and the status of public interest issues like employment are clarified when investigating mergers. So we now see that there's going to be prospect for workers' ownerships. There'll be considerations for the development of new industries, to expand of the industrial base of our economy, and that what we'll be able to do through this law is to take forward many of the great instances of case law and precedents that's developed through some of the bigger mergers that have been taking place recently. And that's the activist role that our state must play if we're going to achieve the objectives that we set for ourselves. And we're really glad to be supporting those measures as we proceed. Many firms would sometimes agree to measures and then not honor those. We appreciate the fact that this law for the first time says that we'll undo the terms of those mergers if the companies employed engaged in those mergers do not comply with the commitments that was made in respect of the terms of those mergers. And we further appreciate the fact that unions now have a right to be part of the market inquiries that are done. And there's a whole section of market inquiries that I'm not going to go into detail today, because my colleagues, both from the Clothing and Textile Workers Union as well as one of the other federations, will in more detail be presenting that sections of the report tomorrow. But we greatly appreciate the fact that we would be involved in those discussions around market inquiries, and that we'd also see that the minister is now able to, from the side of the executive, intervene in mergers and these matters in respect of social policy and employment considerations. On economic concentration, we believe that this bill will help to address the major economic problems in South Africa. We've got to make sure that we respond to the wealth inequalities and the income inequalities, and the fact that the wealth is in so few hands in large sections of the economy. Our economic model is driven on both growing domestic demand, and if we're going to grow domestic demand, then we must deal with the question of pricing, we must deal with the question of income levels, the creation of jobs, and the development of industrial capacity. And so this bill takes us a long way in that direction. We must continue the march to transformation to ensure that the old boys club, who has no regard for the majority of people, that their interest is undone. We've seen of late in instances like Steinhoff that a lot of the ways in which the tentacles of these bigger companies spread across sections of the economy and have been able to manipulate it to extract value and lose huge amounts of money from institutional investors, that those are questions that must be much more carefully looked at. So there's a need for us to start with a conscious process to look into what's happened in the past, the structure of the economy, the structure of companies, and make sure that we are able to respond to that. And that's not just borne out of chair the fact that some people would say we are on a path of revenge to undo the grand theft of apartheid, and the few continued white owners of the economy were the black elite assimilated into their structures. This is about following what are global examples of what actually promotes development and investment. Because it's clear that these high prices, the high barrier to entry, the lack of innovation and inequality, all of those issues are both barriers to our own development, but it's barriers to investors, and it's keeping out international investors, because we're at a real disadvantage in relation to many of our peers in the national economy, in the international economy that's competing with us for foreign direct investment. So this is a matter that's central to our economic development, to our prospects of the future, and it has to be attended to as a matter of urgency. In respect of the market inquiries, I've said before that there's going to be more detailed presentation on that, but I would just say today that it's clear that we think that the Commission's powers that is increased and that is improved for the ability to intervene in many of the practices in the market, that that's going to be of tremendous assistance to ensure that we can respond to many of the challenges that exist. The transformation and ownership issues, I've already tried to allude to the labor movement and Kusatu's views on some of that, but we think that the fact that we're considering public interest as a key factor in whether we're approving mergers for the future and what are the conditions for those mergers, that that's a real victory from the legislatures to the people of our country. The relationship between SMEs, small black businessmen, and the established companies, that is something that's got to change completely, because as we've already tried to point out, there's a huge impediment to the success of small businesses and the ability of them to both enter new markets and become viable players in a context of where the economy is both controlled in some sectors but also controlled across sectors, and how those relations that were struck in the days of apartheid and in the days when monopolies functioned, how those continue to make it difficult. We hope that out of these measures we'll see continued employment opportunities arising for people across the economy, for women, for young people, for those marginal groups in the society, especially who've gone and borne the harshest burden as a result of the inability of our economy to grow jobs. And the inability of the economy to grow the number of jobs that we require is something that we've got to appreciate. We've done well in this country with the GDP of this country doubling and us having doubled the levels of employment, but we're not close to the levels that we require to respond to the challenges that is presented to our people in respect of the deepening levels of unemployment and poverty. And so we have to find new measures of doing things. We can't continue doing things in the old way that the apartheid economic structure and even part of the democratic economic structure had decided upon. There's a time for change and a time for radical transformation. And we believe that with those changes, we must measure our successes both in respect of the transformation of ownership away from white domination to an economy where both white and black and workers and bosses all are able to flourish, and we're able to undo the historical inequities. There are those who will argue, as they always do, that this is just two views on the economy. The one is that we must, it's been in the best interest and we've made some progress in the way the economy is structured at the moment, and the other arguing that we've got to transform it more radically. These are two views, but they are not morally equivalent views. The one is clearly better for our country than the other. The one is clearly more just for our country than the other. And the one serves the overwhelming majority of our people, while the other just continues to perpetuate the advantages of the elite. So the choices that our members in Parliament and this committee must make is clear in respect of the liberation promises that we've made to our people, and we hope that you will continue to serve in the distinguished way that you have, and that those who have historically opposed this kind of transformation, that they continue to raise their concerns in this House so that we can know and identify them for what they are, as oppositions to transformation and the defenders of the historical grand theft of apartheid, because we can't see our people as equal when clearly there are huge distinctions between what it is that they actually do. On the matters related to the national security veto, we believe that the government has a constitutional responsibility to protect South Africa, and to do that, the government must be able to intervene when there are circumstances where companies are able to buy domestic companies that play a strategic role in our economy and in our safety of our country. So, for example, if the majority of the stake in the NAL was to be bought by a foreign-owned company, that has to be something that's carefully and clearly considered by the executive and by the Competition Commission to make sure that we don't endanger our sovereignty and our state security interests. We also have to look at the questions in relation to the private security firms. Already we have a huge amount of foreign-owned private security firms. These are effectively small armies of people that have firearms and that have significant capacity. There is a real danger when they become able to organize and operate outside of the ambit of the national interest. So our government must clearly consider these matters and must look into it to make sure that we are at all times protecting the national interest
as we interact with foreign direct investments and the merging between companies, both domestically and internationally. But these are the fine balances that must be struck, and this is where the elected representatives of our country must play a very active role to set out the terms on which our interests are going to be protected. Many would argue that the regulations are overly burdensome. We don't agree with that. We think we have to make sure that there's clear areas of protection, and we think that we have to find ways in which all of the sectors of society are defended in the way that we proceed. I move on to the section of elevating employment, because for us that's one of the key considerations on any piece of legislation, and the effect of that on employment levels to a large extent determines its success or not, or its benefit or not, to our society as a whole. We're glad that there's a consideration now where employment will be a big consideration as a requirement and a criteria for merger approvals. That's going to go a long way to make sure that the economic developments taking place in our countries, the mergers, the other kind of interactions and agreements and contracts that are signed, that they're mindful of responding to the primary need of South Africans for jobs and for economic development. The role of the Commission, we think it's also going to be much greatly clarified to make sure that they're able to intervene and deal with the challenges both of a social and economic level to ensure that these procedures around the mergers deals with questions of enforcement and questions of non-compliance. There's been a huge debate, and they'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow in respect of the removal of the yellow card. We're 20 years into the democracy. Companies can't today still feign ignorance when they're not complying or when they're purposely colluding or acting in an uncompetitive way or the mergers that they're putting in place is not in the national interest. So we think that the fines and the penalties must be increased. And in that respect, we support the provisions of the law, and we think that that must be maintained to ensure that we not only put in place laws that are progressive and in the interest of our country, but that we make sure that those laws are effective, that they're applied, and if they are non-compliant, there's consequences. The days of people not feeling the consequences of illegal actions must be put behind us in this era of the new dawn of both the President, the ANC as the governing party, and I'm sure Parliament. And so those guilty of these corrupt practices must feel the full might of the law, whether they, the members of this House who were guilty and were guilty of corruption in the past or members in the private sector, they must all feel the fullest might of the law. Because when we steal money in this way, we're effectively stealing money from the poor and from the state's ability to deal with the responsibility of our people. So the benefits of this law is clearly supported by COSATU. Its urgent passage is really begged for from COSATU, from the ministers of this, from the members of this House, and we hope that you'll support it. And we finally hope that this, as a significant step for moving in a different direction, that can in a real way bring about the economic transformation and changes that we hope for from as early as 1994, that those things now actually start to take place. So we welcome this progressive piece of legislation. We welcome its farsightedness. We appreciate the engagements that we have around that. We, of course, are not surprised by some of the attitudes of the business sector, but we don't expect anything else given the role that they played in South Africa. But we, before this, ask to call on you as our public representatives from across the country to make sure that our people's interests are served for the law as it is presented here today. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Costato, for the presentation. What we're going to do now is we're going to allow members to ask questions. So I request you to note all the questions so that you can respond to all of them at once. Members, questions? No questions. Another Magwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just one question on the issue. I think the presenter has raised, and I just want to make sure that I understand his point on this one. You have mentioned that there are members of this house who are receiving who have got shares in big companies. And I'm not sure of that. I don't know how far true is that and if whether it's true or false. But my question is, Chair, is there anything wrong for any member of the House to have shares in any company if it discloses those shares? And what is your worry or your concern there? I just don't get you why you have to highlight this or raise this issue in your presentation amongst other issues you have raised on this bill. Thank you, Chair. Well, any other questions in the presentation? Okay. For me, then, with regard to the bill process, can you please detail the level of engagement which COSATU had in making input on the competition amendment bill during the NEDLAC? Do you think you believe that you were afforded a fair opportunity to make your views heard and understood? The second one on the abuse of dominance. Why is it important to have provisions that deal specifically with suppliers to large businesses? What are some of the issues which you have seen in the industries of the workers which you represent? And then on mergers, do you believe it is important that the minister has the right to appeal decision of the tribunal? If yes, what are the reasons? And if no, why not? And also, do you support the BEE and worker provision that have been added to the major section of the Act? On the issue that you just raised on the national security, why is it important for the executive to have the right to interfere in measures where national security is threatened? Do you believe that the provision in the bill are too broad when compared to other countries which have such provisions? What was your original proposal on this matter? And then on market inquiries, do you believe that the Commission should have binding power to take remedial action following a market inquiry? And if it finds that the structure of market has an adverse effect on competition, why should the Commission not simply have powers to recommend? The last one is on the issue. If you look at the original bill from the department on the issues of guidelines, the National Assembly Portfolio Committee decided to make amendments with regard to the guidelines. It said it should not be guidelines, it should be regulations. So what is your view with regard to that new amendment from the National Assembly? If you can respond to Honorable Makwebu's question and also the question that I've just asked.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you very much for the questions. On the matter of the guidelines, we support the committee's recommendation that the regulations are more directive. And we think it's important that we're very clear about what the intention of the law is, and it need be to help companies who felt that there was some ambiguity in the guidelines or in the fact that there's not a clear direction for them. So we think that that's a positive recommendation from the committee, and we certainly support that. We feel, Chair, that there has been detailed engagement. In fact, this law has been one of the areas where we've, I think, set a new example for how we should be engaging on areas of legislation, both generally as a society, but within NEDLAC, where there's been some difficulties that notwithstanding the NEDLAC Act prescribing the fact that matters that have socioeconomic interest should be engaged with only NEDLAC. Here, since December 2017, we've had a detailed engagement. I think six or seven sessions with the department, the minister himself present in many of those, bilaterals both between government and business and government and labor. And so this was one of the most comprehensive areas of engagement that we've been engaged in. We
notwithstanding that, was very disappointed in the attitude of business who, at the end of that engagement, in spite of having all of those opportunities to present their view, backed away from what was an emerging consensus in that committee. And that again just makes the point for how strong business's interest is in that and how dead set sections of business is on maintaining the practices that clearly benefit them. And I want to come back to that point when I answer the question of big companies in a second. The question of mergers and the appeal to the minister, we think that that is a constructive area of the law, and again my comrades will comment on that in more detail. The provisions around workers are certainly one that we welcome, and we think that this business has to promote, this law must promote transformation in the business sector, but not only swapping white bosses for black bosses, we must also promote cooperatives, broader worker ownership in different forms, and ensure that we deal with that in a variety of ways. The market inquiry provisions, we support that. We think that it is a move in the right direction, and it's certainly going to be able to intervene a lot more earlier in what some of the challenges are in respect of developments that are taking place in the marketplace. And these developments both exclude new entrants, but it also deals with huge pricing problems in the society and contributes to the deepening levels of poverty. So we would support that provisions. The national security provisions, we think that compared to other countries, our law is not necessarily onerous, and we think that it does contribute to addressing what is an important part of what the consideration should be of the executive in respect of national interest. So we welcome that section. But Chair, in a lot more detailed sections, we'll present our positions tomorrow on some of the questions that you've raised, and we'll be happy to, in more detail, provide you with the discussions that have happened. Our points in the response of big companies and the ownership by members of the House may not be directly related, but we do want to flag an issue about when there is vested interest, because there's an obligation in law that that people are to recuse themselves when they have vested interest. Now, sure, you can recuse yourself and in some way that prohibits your direct participation, but that doesn't take away areas of subtle and softer influence on the process. If you look at what that happened in the whole BEE transactions in the country, one of the first companies that put in place BEE deals was Sanlam, an old Afrikaner company that knew they've got to be able to legitimize the economic construct, make sure that there are black shareholders in the economy. But that didn't translate necessarily into the benefits of the majority of black people on whose backs those structures of domination and ownership was built in the economy. So, for example, Goldfields, and I think the Speaker of the House has a 25 million rand stake in Goldfields, there's Aberdare Cables, and the workers were largely excluded from the kind of empowerment that was given to politically connected individuals by those companies. So the point that we're trying to make is we've got to be careful about that. We're not casting a view whether it's good or bad. We're saying that there's vested interest, and we must look at whether that's what we want to do. But the final point, I suppose, is if somebody wants to be in business and enrich themselves, then go to business. If you want to represent the people and build this country, then come to the institutions of government. Come where the will of the people is supposed to be expressed. And we think that more and more we've got to have a conversation about how we separate those interests. Because we can't be all things to all people. People's value systems have clearly been influenced by the power of business over the years. If we look at the deepening level of corruption, not only in the private sector, but also in the public sector. If we look at good comrades who's done the most horrendous things, whether it's VBS Bank or the issues of collusion in Eskom, any of the other state institutions. So we've got to be more and more careful as the custodians of this house of drawing that separation. It's not to pull into question everybody who may have a business interest, but it's a question about looking at what's happening in our country, about the loss of hope of our people in the institutions of governance that they think are being presented in the media and elsewhere as a corrupt institution. institution. Our job is not only to talk about our private virtues, it's to talk about the public policy that influences and directs the South. And so for that reason, we've got to look at those questions also when we have a discussion about the effects of these powerful vested interests. So, Chair, that's the rationale for the point that I make, but I'm not casting aspersions on anyone in the House, but I am drawing a distinction between those who represent the majority of poor people in this country and those who represent business. And they are different parties who represent different interests, and they know who they are, and they know what they stand for. So we must appreciate that that's part of the reality of our engagement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Honorable Makua.
Chair, I don't know if you will allow me. I don't have a question, but just two comments. The first is to say, Chair, the reason why I don't have questions is because looking at the Cossato presentation, my main concern is, what are you saying about the bill that is before us? And in the presentation itself, there are various references to different sections of the bill to emphasize the position that Cossato is taking. And because this has happened in NEDLAG already and has been accommodated by the NA, I can quite appreciate that there are no amendments to the bill that are brought to us now, and therefore have no questions on that, sir. The second thing is, Chair, to just correct on the national security veto, that it is very recent news that only yesterday, on the 12th of November, Minister Rob Davis of the Department of Trade and Industry gazetted the defense sector BEE code, and an element of that codes is also to look at the private security companies. The concerns being raised by Cossato about the role played by security companies is hopefully addressed. We would want to urge Cossato then to look at those codes and maybe, if need be, engage with us in government to make sure that the concerns that you have here in the bill before us are indeed adequately given attention to in the BEE codes. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I don't know if you want to respond on the comments.
Just to welcome that, it certainly is enlightening, and we're glad to see our government going in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me take this opportunity to thank Cossato for the presentation, but also thank you for accommodating us to come earlier than originally scheduled. The process now is that I see that you are talking about another presentation tomorrow. This is your only opportunity, but if you have additional information, you can send that in writing to our committee secretary, and copies of such will also be sent to the department. So what is going to happen is that the department is going to respond to all the submissions. And submissions were coming in. We also send the copies of such submissions to the department so that then the department could then respond to those submissions. What then will happen after the responses of departments, we will then deliberate as a committee on the submissions that were made by the stakeholders, such as yourself, and also the responses of the department. We will deliberate on those and then express our views as a committee, make amendments, influenced by yourselves as inputters, are also influenced by the responses of the department. Thank you once again for your contribution. Honourable Member, I'm not sure if we have the Law Society of South Africa present here, or this, but next, but though in terms of time, we still have time. Are they here? Are you ready to present? You can come in front here.
before they come, you know, there are some people who put out the last minute, so that we lose a lot of time. Now we want to say, debate with you in that aspect.
Can we have a 5 minutes break whilst we're sorting out the connection? Thank you.
Maar het is een getijde presentatie gekregen.
Hoe is het gekregen?
Ik heb daar nog enige gekeken waar je naar.
Honourable members, can we review, resume with our meeting? I think logistics have been sorted out, so we can resume with our meeting. Let me take this opportunity to welcome Mr. Paul Kutsia from Law Society of South Africa and give you the platform to make a presentation on your views on the amendment bill on competition. Benjo.
Good morning. Uh,
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. Firstly, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide the Law Society's views on the Competition Amendment Bill and to address any questions that you may have. We regard it as a big honour and a privilege to appear in front of this August House. Just to explain a bit briefly by way of background, that the Law Society of South Africa is a national broad-based voluntary association for attorneys, which include members such as the Black Lawyers Association, the National Association of Democratic Lawyers, and then the Voluntary Provincial Attorneys Associations. This committee may be aware that until the 31st of October, there used to be provincial statutory law societies. But on the 1st of November, that has all been replaced by the Legal Practice Council. So there's a new statutory regime for all legal practitioners in South Africa. However, the Law Society of South Africa continues to exist, but it exists as a voluntary association. And therefore, we make our presentations on behalf of that body. And what this body is about is the Competition Law Committee of the LSSA practices in front of the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal on a daily basis. So we've got a multitude of views. We see these regulators in practice. We know where the difficulties are. We know where the law doesn't work well and where the law does work well and ought to be strengthened and the gaps to be filled. So we think we're in a good position to assist this committee in its deliberations on the bill. We're also in the Competition Amendment Bill process have consulted with certain advocates as well as expert competition law economists to give their views so that it's a comprehensive set of documents. So we have previously given comments on the draft bill that was presented issued in December 2017, comprehensive set of comments, as well as the A version of the bill that was issued in July 2018, and we made presentations to the Portfolio Committee. We then have given this committee a set of written submissions, and of course today we will give the oral presentation. We wanted to be very clear with this committee and with Parliament generally, is that we are very supportive of the work of the competition authorities in South Africa. They've done tremendously good work to already intervene in markets where necessary, and their independence is paramount. And therefore, anything that undermines the work of the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal, we will very much oppose. It is important that those bodies are strengthened, that they be given strong legislation for them to continue to make our markets competitive and intervene where that's not the case. That is not, of course, to say that we don't always agree with them. We do from time to time cross swords as legal practitioners and attorneys, as is necessary for any piece of legislation which a regulator enforces. It's to test the limits of the law, but also to make sure that they do their work properly and for the best benefit of the citizens of South Africa. What is particularly important is that the Competition Commission maintains transparency, fairness, and accountability as an independent institution. We have seen that in the past. To the extent that we haven't seen it, we have called it out, and we will continue to call it out. So the background to this bill, therefore, is, or our presentation, is not to repeat all our written submissions. That's there for the committee to study, and we are very happy if you have any questions in that regard to answer those questions. But we wanted to focus on five core issues which we think is necessary to grapple with. The first one relates to the regime of administrative penalties. There are some amendments to the penalty section, and we want to address that particularly. Then Section 18A, the national security legislation, that is well known. I heard the previous speaker also refer to that. We want to make a number of submissions in that regard.
Number three is about biopower or monopsony abuse provisions that have now been inserted in Section 8.4 of the Act. Then the price discrimination sections. And then finally, if we have enough time, we can also refer to the whole issue of regulations versus guidelines, which the Chair also mentioned in the previous presentation. I think it's important that we underline what our views are in that regard. So with your permission, if I can then go on to the first topic, and that is administrative penalty. So the committee will have seen that the effectively that the bill has proposed that penalties be increased, and that is in two particular sections. The one is that for a second offender, it is now proposed that the penalties be increased from 10% to 25%. Okay. And secondly, there used to be a so-called yellow card offence for certain offences. It was only possible to be fined or penalised on the second contravention for certain of those offences. And that is mostly in the area where there was a so-called rule of reason test, which I will come back to. And I think the department has also said that they expect that there will be more penalties levied and more funds will flow into the state coffers as a result of these provisions. Also, the more effective enforcement of certain of the provisions that were previously not very well enforced. So, we expect that, that there's going to be also an increasing burden on firms that are found wanting and found guilty of that. That's why the Competition Authority is particularly successful in levying penalties. I've cited there just in the last 10 years, they've raised 6.632 billion rand in terms of penalties. The Competition Authorities have been going for 19 years. We couldn't find the statistic for the first 10 years, but and we expect that that's in the same amount. So there's a huge amount of money that has come into the state coffers, and one will potentially be tempted to say they are a good source of income for government. But we think that that's unfortunately the wrong perspective to look at this. And the key point in this is that the people suffering harm for anti-competitive practices are not compensated. So every anti-competitive practice that is condemned by the competition authorities has an impact not only on a firm, but potentially on consumers. Because the Competition Act, as the committee knows, is about the consumer welfare and protecting the consumers. So if the firm that contravenes the Act, it does harm to the consumers and some other firms in the market. Now, potentially, a firm can claim damages from the contravener, but the reality is that that never happens. So the past 19 years, that's only happened successfully on two occasions, and that was when Nationwide and Comair instituted damages against SAA. But these are huge firms, Nationwide and Comair, with huge resources to fund such litigation. But for the small firm, for the historically disadvantaged-owned firm, and for the consumer, it's very, very difficult to ever get properly compensated. And it will be a long time before I think we will see that happen in South Africa. It is so that the tribunal will take into account, when it sets the penalty, the loss or damage suffered as a result of the contravention, but because it's so complex and difficult to prove that, it never happens in our experience. Also, a consent order, i.e. if a firm pleads guilty, that may include an award of damages to the complainant with his consent. But again, I know of only one instance in the past 19 years where that has happened, and that was for a very small amount. So what we say that there is a problem here, and that the problem is that the people that are being harmed by this conduct is not... there's no benefits flowing to them. All the monies are just flowing to the state coffers, and then it is dispersed. So the question that we want to pose to this committee is, how do you restore that balance? How do you address that problem? And it is not something that is in the existing competition amendment bill, but we would propose that it is something that could be inserted in the bill and that it would be beneficial to the bill. So if it is something that the committee can take up with the department, that would be a good idea. So the solution that has come to the fore in the past few years is that the Competition Tribunal and the Competition Commission has been looking more creatively at solutions to contravention. So they not only impose a penalty, but potentially also say that you must keep your prices stable for a period of time, or you must agree to spend a certain amount of capital expenditure in your firm, so the money has come back into the economy. And we think that is good. That we think that is a proper measure to restore the balance in the market. However, there is a problem still, though. In the Pioneer Foods case, which was a consent order some 5-6 years ago, the proposed penalty was going to be 500 million rand. And the Commission then had agreed with Pioneer that 250 million of that, i.e. half of the amount of 500 million, should be the administrative penalty that goes into the National Revenue Fund, and 250 million goes into agro-processing competitiveness fund that would be administered by the IDC. And the aim of that fund would be to promote competitiveness, employment, and growth in food value chains. Now, the difficulty was when that was presented to the tribunal for enforcement or for the tribunal to confirm that, the National Treasury stopped the bus and they said, no, it's our money. You can't take this. It's diverted into a competitiveness fund. It should go to the state. And then from there on, the state can decide what they want to do with it. So eventually then the resolution was that the administrative penalty was 500 million and that's where it stopped. However, somehow it was able through the process of appropriation for that fund still to be formed and therefore 250 million was allocated to a development fund. So we think that these type of funds is a brilliant way to get back and restore the balance. So the agro-processing competitiveness funds have had good effects in the market. If you like, I can take you through that, but there are newsletters of the Competition Commission that have explained how well they have applied that money to promote competitiveness, funding of small businesses in the agricultural value chain, business support functions, bursaries for people in that area, and so on. These type of funds have also been used in the context of mergers, where the Competition Tribunal approved mergers. So there's a number of mergers where foreign firms came into the country, notably AB InBev, Coca-Cola, and the like, where these companies agreed, and Walmart, I should not forget Walmart, because that was the first one, came into the country and then agreed after reaching agreement with the Minister of Economic Development and the Competition Commission that a certain amount will be set aside to such a fund, either for supplier development or for the promotion of smaller and historically disadvantaged owned firms. So we say that these are excellent examples of how the funds that are paid by contraveners of the Act can be used to work their way back into the economy in a proper and a productive way. And that is something to be promoted. Finally, more recently, a number of companies were found guilty in the media agency industry, and again, the Commission there, with their consent, was able to develop such a fund, which will hopefully have good benefits. So where's the problem then? If I say it has happened, what do we need to do? The problem is that the Competition Tribunal, once it has found somebody guilty of a contravention of the Act, at the moment does not have the power to order such a fund. All that the tribunal can order for the moment is an administrative penalty, and they can order them to do certain things and not do certain things, but they cannot have such a fund established. And our proposal would be that Section 59(1) of the Competition Act be supplemented to give the competition authorities the power to include such the establishment of such fund as part of a package of remedies for contraventions. So it's something that's a creative remedy that as I say, can effectively come back and do some positive things for the economy. You may ask, but who would be the administrators of such fund? Who would be the people that will look after the proper spending of this amount of money? And how do we ensure that no corruption creeps in and that true independence also runs? Well, that's obviously very important that is also looked after. In the case of the agro-processing fund, the Industrial Development Corporation played that role. In some of these other funds, the Economic Development Department played a role, and so we think that those are good suggestions. In the case of the media companies that I've mentioned, it's the Media Diversity Agency, which is an independent agency that played that role. So one can find actors in the market that can play an independent role. And to look after that money and to ensure that it is not diverted for other resources that are not appropriate. That has been our submissions on the penalties. We do not contest that there is a need for heavy penalties to be meted on contravenors of the Act as a proper deterrence. However, as we say, those funds should not go only into the state coffers. It should be used more productively. Chair, then on the second topic is the question of national security and Section 18A particularly. Now, to be clear, this was a new section that came into the Act. In the December draft bill that was released, there was no reference to Section 18A. So it came out of the blue. And we understand also that in the NEDLAC process, and we were not there, so I can't say with authority, but we understand through the grapevine that this section of the Act came in very late in the process and wasn't really even given proper attention. Much of the focus was on the competition issues and the public interest issues. We query in our written submission whether there was indeed proper consultation on this aspect of the bill. And it doesn't look to us in the explanatory memorandum whether the various government clusters and also the various committees, select committees in Parliament, portfolio committees of Parliament, even gave their attention to this very important piece of legislation. And the reason for that, we suspect, is because it's buried away in a competition bill. Nobody would expect something to do with national security in a competition bill. And that is our main issue with this, is this legislation is far-reaching in nature. And if not properly considered or properly drafted, it can have adverse consequences for foreign direct investments. And we come back to that. Now, we would be the first people to say, of course, South Africa's national security should be protected. It's important that this country have laws to protect it against serious threats to its democracy, its independence, its sovereignty, and its national security. Those laws need to be there to protect the citizens against terrorism, against biological threats, and so on. So the stock examples that you get where a foreign company comes in and it takes over Danel or it takes over defense procurement, we could see that could potentially be harmful and that the state should be able to intervene in those particular areas and block those mergers, as indeed do many countries over in the world have such powers, and therefore we don't think it's wrong to have such powers, but we worry that, number one, that this bill is or this component, these provisions are buried away in a competition bill where nobody will look for it. Number two, we think that it ought to be properly considered, more deeply consulted with, and not rushed through because it's got such far-reaching consequences. So what are the consequences? The consequences is that South Africa is looking for foreign investments. 2 weeks ago, as the committee will know, we held an investment conference in South Africa, and good announcements were made of the investments that were going to be committed to South Africa. But as we go on, we must appreciate that South Africa has to compete against other countries that are looking for foreign investment. And they will certainly look at a country that has more red tape and more hoops to jump through, and where there's a lot of executive discretion to block a merger, and rather go to a country that does not have such constraints. And yes, I know people can say, well, America has similar legislation, and China does, and so on and so forth. Those countries are not competing against us for investment. It is South Africa competing with other developing countries. And so the more stumbling blocks we put in the way, and where there's lots of discretion or lots of uncertainty, that scares away investors. I think it's a stock saying that capital hates uncertainty, it loves certainty. Now, we say that take this piece of legislation, Section 18A, have it properly considered, let a white paper be issued, let it properly be debated with the security agencies, with all the other clusters of government and parliament that may have potentially have an interest, and see that we have the best piece of legislation to protect South Africa, but on a basis where it doesn't affect our international competitiveness. And that is our first proposal. I've not kept up to date with my slides on the screen. So then we say, but if the committee and the government is not minded to consider this, and we still maintain it should be seriously considered this, then we say, let us then drill down into the meat of this bill, into the minutiae, and see why we say this shouldn't be ill-considered. And the difficulty is that two things, apart from a lot of the other things that we've already made submissions on and relates to the way that it could, the technicality, so to speak, but the two biggest issues is, number one, that the concept of a national security interest is so widely defined that virtually any economic activity falls under it, and I will demonstrate that to the committee. We think that that is going overboard. It has spread the net so wide that allows the government to intervene on virtually every commercial endeavor from a foreign firm in South Africa, or when it wants to invest in South Africa. And secondly, there is no standard or benchmark that government's intervention can be measured against. It is vague, to say the least. It doesn't say how serious the threat to national security should be before blocking a foreign merger. And the result of that is that effectively you allow the executive just a free discretion. And that is not a good way of lawmaking. The more discretion you allow, the further away you move away from the rule of law. So if I can then move into the detail on the fourth bullet point on the slide. Section 18A4 says, in determining what constitutes national security interest for purposes of the Act, the President must take into account all relevant factors, including the potential impact of a merger transaction, and then it lists a number of criteria that we'll come to. The problem is, as I say, with that opening line, there's no criteria. There's no seriousness or materiality. So we would propose, if the committee is minded to keep Section 18A in the Competition Amendment Bill, to at the very least put such a measurement or a benchmark there by adding the word which could seriously threaten the security of the Republic. including the potential adverse impact of a merger transaction. So if you'll see on the screen, what we have done is to underline the words that the Law Society proposes should be inserted in the Act to at least have a materiality or a substantiality benchmark there against which the government's intervention in foreign mergers can be tested. And then Section 18A7, which talks about the decisions by this Committee on National Security, should be amended accordingly to repeat that benchmark. That is the first proposal. The second proposal is that we say, let us look at the types of things that the amendment bill says are national security interests, and at least dial them down to make sure that it really truly relates to national security and it is truly a threat for the government. So we start with subsection C. So you'll remember the introductory part says, in determining what constitutes national security interest for purposes of the Act, the President must take into account all relevant factors, including the potential impact of the merger transaction on, and then it goes into the subsections. So the first one that we have a beef with is C, which talks about the security of infrastructure, including processes, systems, facilities, technologies, networks, assets, and services essential to health, safety, security, or economic well-being of citizens and effective function of government. Now, I challenge anybody to demonstrate to me that that is not so wide as to include every commercial endeavor. The words assets or services is everything. Anything is an asset. This bottle of water, the service that I rent to my client is a service. And then when it relates to the economic well-being of citizens, virtually everything is for the economic well-being. Even the person that drinks that bottle of water or buys that bottle of water. So we say that is simply too wide, and it cannot be. And if this this bill is indeed, or this section of the bill is indeed compared to international benchmarks or international examples, we do not find that it goes as wide as the South African legislation does. And in my in our submissions, our written submissions, we have referred to a paper of the OECD, the Organization of Economic Development, which can be consulted by the committee, where there's a representative sample of 17 countries. And yes, certainly some countries goes wider than defense and armaments and that type of national security, but they do not go as far as involving every aspect of the economic activity in South Africa. Now, we think that there's a fix, and we would propose to the committee such a fix. Again, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so we propose in our bullet point that the word and resources are inserted, also that the words economic well-being of citizens and the effective governing of government is deleted. Chair, may I just introduce my colleague, Unati Chukuda. We were slotted for a later slot, he didn't know that we were starting earlier. Thank you, Chair. So again, just to underline, therefore, we propose that subsection C reads as follows: on the security of infrastructure, including processes, systems, facilities, technologies, networks, and resources essential to the health, safety, or security of citizens, and then take away the effective function of government. We think that if this committee is minded to allow Section 18A, at the very least that section should be reduced or dialed back. The next one is Section D, subsection D, and this the wording of that one is on the supply of critical goods or services to citizens or the supply of goods or services to government. Now, once again, the words critical goods is vague and unqualified. It's not clear what is a critical good or what is not a critical good. Is water a critical good? Some people may say yes. Other people may, perhaps people in Cape Town will say yes. because of the scarcity. But other things, is it clear whether these things are critical goods? Electricity, agriculture, housing, legal services, is that a critical good? Some people will say yes. Auditing services, information technology. So one cannot put so much discretion in the hands of the executive that it is for them to decide what is critical or not critical. Again, we propose a change, and that is, apologies, it should say subsection B, on the supply of goods or services which are essential to the health, safety, or security of citizens. And the committee will see that that mirrors the words in the previous subsection that also talks about the health, the safety, and the security of South African citizens. All the supply of goods or services, and again we propose the inserted words which are critical to the effective functioning of government. But again, open-ended, too vague, those are things that offend against the rule of law, and we say should not be allowed. There's just two more of these subsections. I go to the next one. The next one relates to South Africa's international relationships. And the wording in subsection F talks about simply a factor is on the Republic's international interest, including foreign relationships. Once again, so vague. What is international interest? You know, that every investor in South Africa has an impact on South Africa's quote-unquote international interest because it impacts of goods or services across our borders. That cannot be what the legislator had in mind here. What they probably had in mind is the relationship with other countries and international organizations such as the UN or the OECD and things like that. So once again, we propose here, don't put vague wording in the subsection and give too much discretion to the executive. Rather, make it very specific. It's about the Republic's relationship with other countries or international organizations, multi-country organizations. And then finally on this section, Chair, it is the question of the so-called catch-all section. And for us, the catch-all section is probably the worst of the worst. And that is because the catch-all section talks about the economic and social stability of the Republic. Now, virtually everything in the world can be said to relate to the economic and to the economic stability of the Republic. And therefore, it effectively means that every merger by a foreign firm should get the consent of the executive, and that cannot be. South Africa will drive away foreign investment. Secondly, more importantly, what is meant by the word social stability? We have done a bit of research to try and find out what does that term mean. I think the term is unclear. Even social scientists doesn't know, and I've not seen it in any other legislation in South Africa or in other foreign countries that deals with this type of legislation. One definition describes it as follows. It's a sociological perspective that states that a group always seeks to maintain equilibrium by forcing out ideas and individuals that disagree with popular opinion. This helps to keep society in balance and promotes harmonious coexistence. Well, if that's what social stability means, I don't think that is a term that can be allowed to stay in our legislation in a democracy, because it forces other views out, and it allows people to just think in a box. So our proposal is to move away from the idea of economic and social stability. Our proposal is to at least say, if you are worried about something that has a major impact, it's about South Africa's financial systems and the stability of its payment systems. And that is clearly an important thing, because if there's an attack on the banks or on the big insurance companies, then of course we will all suffer. So if there's a merger that has an implication on any of those things, it will potentially be very damaging to the citizens, and that is something that the executives can intervene in. Incidentally, they already have the power to do so, because in the Competition Amendment Act it says that the Minister of Finance can override the Competition Authority's consideration of a merger if they believe that it is very important to do so. And they have done so in a number of cases where there was a merger of or a takeover of a bank, and they said, we don't want the Competition Authorities to look at this. It's too important for us for the systemic banking reasons. That merger should go through. And we think that that is something that can be supported. So, in summary, therefore, we do not believe that Section 18A belongs in the Competition Act. We believe that it belongs in a self-standing or standalone piece of legislation. It needs to be properly considered by the various parts of government and Parliament, and perhaps a wider debate is engaged in before it is legislated. And then secondly, if it is indeed kept on consideration into the Act, then various changes must be made so that it is not so wide that it scares away foreign investment. And certainly we do say that South Africa will be the country with the most far-reaching type of protection mechanisms than in any of the other ones that we have looked at. Chair, can I then move on to the next main topic of our five main topics, if I have enough time? So the radically new provision in our legislation relates to the control of so-called buyer power or monopsony power. And this is where a company needs to purchase from another company, and that company is such a large company, it's a dominant company in the market, that it can lord itself, if you like, over the suppliers and effectively affect competition negatively. So it is an economic concept that it can increase the harm to the market, and we think it is therefore legitimate for it to be addressed specifically. And I have observed some of the representations that were made by smaller firms in the market to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, and also in our experience we have seen how smaller firms can be negatively impacted by the abuse of buyer power. So again, we don't have a difficulty that there is an attempt to address it in the Competition Amendment Bill. However, we say that there are severe difficulties with the way that it has now come out as a result of the deliberations in the Portfolio Committee. And we are now left with a concept which we think would simply lead to a lot of litigation. And if that is the case, then potentially these sections will never have their intended effect. It will be tied up in the courts for many, many, many years. And we think that there's a simple way to address it so that you don't get into those difficulties. Let me go to each of those sections. The three main areas, we have in our written submission set out more, but the three core issues are the following. Firstly, there's this concept of unfairness. And we think that the word and the term unfairness is so vague that it's not capable of being enforced. Secondly, there's no availability of an efficiency defense anymore, and I'll explain in detail. And then finally, everything is made worse by the fact that there's a shifting of the evidentiary burden. So I'm going to deal with those three topics independently. So the prohibition in Section 8.4 of the bill says that it is prohibited for a dominant firm in a designated sector to directly or indirectly require from or impose on a supplier that is a small or medium business or a firm controlled or owned by historically disadvantaged persons unfair prices or unfair trading conditions. So effectively, a dominant firm can't demand from a small SMME or a HDP supplier unfair prices or unfair trading conditions. Now, I challenge anybody to tell me when is a price unfair. The difficulty is we don't know what is unfair. One man's unfairness may be another woman's fairness. It is a very subjective component, and it provides so much doubt in the mind of the person that has to comply with this provision that that person or that firm would simply not know what to do. And that is essentially unfair. It's a foundational tenet of our democracy, and that laws must be so clear that citizens know it in advance what to do to avoid falling foul of the law. And if we can't say that, then we have no laws. And that is why I believe very strongly that this particular provision in its existing form will be challenged on a constitutional basis. It gives the enforcer so much discretion to say, today this is unfair, tomorrow that's not unfair. So you effectively give the regulator such power of dominant firms that it makes it impossible for firms in the market to operate properly. And again, there's nothing in our law that says it's wrong to be a dominant firm. Dominant firms are allowed. And again, remember, the dominance is not a firm with a 90% market share. It's as low as 35% can be regarded as a dominant firm. So, and according to the Commission's study that gave rise to this legislation, there are at least 463 such firms in South Africa. Now, for those 463 firms, I suggest that they don't know what to do when dealing with SMME and HDP suppliers. They don't know what prices they should charge them or what is unfair or not fair. Now, it might be said that, don't worry, you can look at other pieces of legislation where it talks about fairness. Unfortunately, there are no such pieces of legislation in South Africa. We have looked for them, we can't find them. It's almost tantamount to saying you should behave yourself. But for there to be law to be saying, behave yourself, it doesn't tell the subject or the citizen what he or she must do in order to behave himself. This vague concept has given difficulties in other competition jurisdictions. We mentioned specifically in Zambia, there has been such a legislation or such a concept, and it has been found wanting. We have a good example in the existing Competition Act where the word excessive pricing was used for the past 20 years. And that concept in itself, even though there was a defined meaning given for it in Section 1, was found to be so difficult that the Commission over the past 19 years have not been able to get one conviction on it. Such that there is now in the Competition Amendment Bill, I can give you the subsection, a vast definition of what is meant by excessive pricing. So it feels to us that although the bill gives with the one hand, creates more certainty on what is excessive, it then introduces huge uncertainty with regard to the fairness standard. If the government wants to and the legislature wants to prescribe what is fairness or unfairness, we have no difficulty with that. But then it ought to be set out so that the citizen know in advance with more precision what is meant. By default, we say we think we have a solution, and we set that out on slide 14. We say at the very least, replace the term unfairness with the more precise standard of quote-unquote impeding the ability of such suppliers in the applicable market to participate in the market. Now, I'd be the first person to admit that that's not without its problems, But at the very least, there is a measurement that you can, you can, a dominant firm can at least consider whether its pricing or its trading terms will impact severely on smaller firms in the market, as opposed to this vague concept of what is unfair or not fair. And once again, the biggest issue is that they will litigate to declare that term unconstitutional. So,
I just want to see where is your new proposal?
Yes, Chair, on this slide, it's the third bullet point. Are you, if you're on slide 14?
Mine doesn't have a number, oh. Page number.
Chair, if you look on the screen, it's the slide that starts with the word "this vague concept." The word "this vague concept."
Buy a power.
Yeah. Okay, so on that slide, the third bullet point, we say, the LSSA therefore proposes to replace the unfairness standard with a more precise standard of, quote, impeding the ability of such suppliers in the applicable market to participate. So that will then be as the benchmark in section 8.4a. Okay, but if we can go to the next slide, we say that this difficulty with unfairness, you know, or the unfairness of the unfairness, is being compounded by various other subsections in the law that shows how difficult it is to police and how difficult it is for a dominant firm there to find itself in this situation. The first one is, unlike Section 8A, which is the other abuse of, unlike Section 8, which is the other abuse of dominant section, there's no need for the commission or the complainant to prove that somebody was harmed by the abuse of conduct. In the other sections of the Act, the commission must prove somebody was harmed. Prices were increased or somehow they were not able to grow in the market. The second issue is that in those other subsections, a dominant firm had a defense. It could say, well, I may have not given you exactly the same prices as the biggest firm in the market, but I did so for efficiency reasons, or it was because I promoted technology, or there was some pro-competitive measurement. That defense is no longer available after it was moved in the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee from Section 8A, also from Section 8C or Section 8D to its separate subsection. So there's no such efficiency or rule of reason defense anymore. And then finally, there is a shifting of the evidentiary burden. And particularly, if I can just take the committee through that particular provision, in Section 8.4b, 8.4c, it says that if a firm, if you could just bear with me for a moment, C of the Competition Amendment Bill, it says, if there is a prima facie case of a contravention of paragraph A or B, the dominant firm alleged to be in contravention must show that, in the case of paragraph A, the price or other trading condition is not fair. So this dominant firm, is not unfair. It's not unfair. Thank you, Chair. So the point is, how do you prove a negative? How do you prove that you act in a way that is fair? I challenge every firm out there, whether it's a large or a small firm or every person, to say, I can prove to you I'm acting fairly. How do you do that? I don't know. So it's very difficult for us to see how this reverse onus or this shifting of the onus will operate in practice, but more importantly, If you add that to the vague concept of unfairness, if you add that to the fact that there's no defense of efficiency, then you say that this particular section is very likely to come under attack for constitutionality. And if that's the case, then the section will never get out of the starting blocks, and this SMME and HDP suppliers that it is intended to help will never be helped. So, and then finally, there is also a non-circumvention provision in Section 84B. In itself, we don't have a difficulty with that, but again, there's a reverse onus. You must prove that you did not seek, that you did not refuse to supply a small supplier in order to circumvent the section. So you are effectively, as a dominant firm, forced to deal or to purchase from a small supplier, regardless of what it costs you. And this is the important part for this committee. It can have adverse consequences for the consumer, because it means that you're going to have to deal with people even if it costs you more, and those costs are passed on to the consumer. So we propose, in order to at least alleviate this problem, that this section be moved to Section 8.4, from Section 8.4 to Section 8D of the Act, which deals with other abuses of dominance, but also allows for efficiency defense, and to remove the provision of shifting the evidentiary burden from the bill. We think that at the very least, it should alleviate some of the problems, and again, going back to the concept of unfairness, we think that that should be replaced with this more precise standard of impacting the ability to participate in the market. Okay, that has been all on buyer power or monopsony power. Again, what we say is we do appreciate that there's a good rationale for it, but we are not aware of why there is a need for a shifting of the onus and in a sense, upsetting the presumption of innocence of a very vague concept. The fourth idea, if I can move on to that in the remaining time, is price discrimination. Now, this section has undergone some revisions from when the bill was first issued in July until the B version of the bill was passed by the National Assembly. And what had happened here is that the term, sorry, I am on the slide that said it, price discrimination. What had happened here is that the existing formulation of price discrimination says that the complainant or the commission must prove that there is a substantial impact of competition in the market. And the commission and the competition authorities have found that that limits the number of price discrimination cases that they can bring, and they feel that their hands are tied. They took that substantiality requirement out of the bill, or it was proposed in the bill that it's taken out of the Act. After the portfolio committee, they put it back in for large firms, but they do not require that for small and medium firms and historically disadvantaged owned firms. So there's a special category in Section 9, in the proposed Section 9, let me just get there, in Section 9.1A, Roman numeral 2. So for small and medium firms and historically disadvantaged firms, those firms, the complainant or the commission does not have to prove a substantial preventing or lessening of competition. We're not going to debate that. We understand where it's coming from, and if it achieves the objective of a more rigorous price discrimination enforcement, then that is probably a healthy outcome. However, two other things have been introduced, which will again give rise to big problems in this Act and give rise to unintended consequences, we say. And that the first one relates to the removal of the cost differentiation or scale efficiency defense. Now, that is at the moment in section 9, subsection 9, bracket 3, bracket A. And how this works is that at the moment a firm that makes a differentiation in prices between its customers can defend itself on the basis that it says, well, if I make this product, this bottle of water, for this particular customer, it costs me X. If I make it for that customer, it costs me Y. So that differentiation in cost, I am able to give the benefit of that cost differentiation through to the customer. And it comes down to effectively a volume discount. So for customer A, if you make for that customer 1 million units of this bottled water, it stands to reason it's going to cost you less than making one bottle of water for customer B. And all that the Act at the moment says is that cost differentiation you're entitled to rely on as a defense. I'm giving the customer the benefit of my cost saving. That benefit or that defense has been taken out by in section 93A with regard to HDP and SMME firms. So effectively, in respect of smaller firms and historically disadvantaged firms, a company can no longer say, well, it's going to cost me three times or four times more to sell you that one bottle of water. Okay? I cannot, why must I sell it to you at the same price as I sell it to the company that orders 1 million bottles of water? So that will eventually give rise to an increase in prices, and we will all as consumers suffer as a result of that. We do not think that that is justified in the circumstances. It will have unintended consequences. That's not to say that a firm is always entitled to give a volume discount to a firm that that orders more. It's only when that firm can demonstrate that it has saved some cost. So if the 1 million bottles of water cost per unit exactly the same as the one bottle of unit, we agree that bottle of water to the smaller customer must come at the same price. We don't find any difficulty with that. But it is, if there is a cost saving or a scale economy benefit, then that ought to be retained and that can be passed through to the consumer for the benefit of the consumer. And then secondly, very much similar to the buyer power provision, there's also here a reverse onus or a shifting of the evidentiary burden. And what we say here is, well, why are you introducing this? Has there been so much difficulty in the past 19 years that we now think that we ought to upset the normal processes of law? And we say no. The complainant and the commission must still be able to prove, and it should be easily able to prove, number one, that there is a differential in prices. That's not rocket science. One product is sold at one price, another product is sold at another price, and there's no defense here for a substantial lessening of competition. So it should be a relatively light burden, but the difficulty is for a dominant firm to prove the negative is going to be virtually impossible. And we think, again, that offends against the constitutionality of this provision. And unfortunately, once again, this will just lead to unnecessary, costly, long-during litigation up to the constitutional courts, which will make it very difficult for the Commission. We propose to remove Section 9(3) and Section 9(3) capital letter A from the bill, and we believe that would at least allay the concerns that do exist from a constitutional point of view, and that allow the bill still to do its intended work. Finally, Chair, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I've kept the committee for a very long time already. Is this issue of regulations versus guidelines? Now, in the first version of the bill, it said that in various sections of the bill, the commission must issue guidelines. It must issue guidelines for contravention of Section 4, also for Section 5, vertical prohibitions, and for certain abuses of dominance. But then it says that the guidelines must be observed. So if a person doesn't observe the guideline, it can have severe consequences. And also when it comes to penalties, it says the person imposing the penalty will look at whether you follow the guidelines. That effectively then became tantamount to a piece of law, and the LSSA, amongst others, objected to that. Well, what happened in the portfolio committee is that government, portfolio committee changed that to remove the reference to guidelines and made it into regulations. And we think that that is taking the taking a screwdriver and now making it into a hammer. If the guidelines were problematic, regulations are even more problematic. And we say so because regulations are appropriate for dealing with administrative and procedural matters, but regulations of a cannot set new tests or new standards or new substantive provisions by the executive, because they're issued by the executive. They cannot make new law that is different or an expansion of the law that the parliament had passed. If there's a desire to make new laws, it must come back to this house. And this house must then consider whether it is good for the citizen. It must go through a public consultation process, and then it can pass those laws. So we agree with the amendment bill that where it relates in section 84D Roman numeral 1 and section 948, I think this is on my last slide, the second bullet. In those subsections which where the minister can pass regulations in order to show what types of industries must be protected against biopower provisions and what type of historically disadvantaged benchmarks should be set, that we think is legitimate. That is the role of regulations. That's how we all understand regulations. But for the rest, if there is explanations of the law or examples given on how the law ought to be interpreted, that appears in other jurisdictions, for instance in the European Union and in the American Department of Justice issues very helpful guidelines in this area. And we all as practitioners find it very useful, provided it's well understood that those guidelines are not binding, because they can only be guidelines. And therefore, and this is my final word, if the LSSA proposes to change all references in the bill to regulations, all references of regulations to guidelines, except for sections 84D1 and 94A, the ones that I have mentioned is permissible. And then we also propose to amend section 794 and section 593H to make clear that the guidelines are not binding, that they are simply guidelines. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate your attention. At the moment, the wording of section 794, I can take the committee to it. There's two provisions of that nature that suggest that it must be given a binding nature. If I can direct the committee to page 22 of the B version of the bill on section 79, subsection 4, it says the guideline referred to in this in subsection 1 is not binding, so that part we agree with, but then it goes on, but any person interpreting or applying this act must take it into account, and the last wording after but is a new insertion in the act. It does not not in the existing act. And we say that that seems to imply that you have to follow it. So it's in contradiction with the previous section that says it's not binding. And then if the committee can just page back two pages to page 20 of the bill, of the amendment bill, and if I can direct your attention to the proposed changes to section 59, okay, so and this would be under subsection 8 rather. So one of the considerations that the tribunal will take into account for determining the penalty says whether the conduct has previously been found to be a contravention of this act, we don't have a difficulty with that, or is substantially the same conduct regarding which guidelines have been issued by the Competition Commission in terms of section 79. We say that that elevates these guidelines to effectively binding provisions, binding laws. So we would propose that section 79.4 stop after the word non-binding, i.e. to delete the words but any person interpreting or applying this act must take it into account, and then in 59H to remove the wording or is substantially the same as conduct regarding which guidelines have been issued by the Competition Commission in terms of section 79, which seems to confuse the binding or the non-binding nature of guidelines. We think it must be abundantly clear that the guidelines cannot be binding. It must clearly be examples. Thank you, Chair. Those are my submissions.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Really substantive. And I would at this stage allow members then to ask questions. As previously with the previous presenter, you take note of the questions and then you respond to them at once. Honorable Magwebu, Honorable Faba, Honorable Makue, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Kosse, for your presentation. Let's just, I think the context is important, and I know we are on the same page on this one. This bill is undoubtedly another attempt or an effort to address the challenge of economic exclusion that the country is still grappling with, given our history. And you have mentioned that you support the tribunal, you support the Competition Commission, which is great. But I want to deal with the issues you have raised in your submissions. Let's start with administrative penalties. I just need clarity. You have suggested that a solution, when you have used the case of Pioneer Foods, where you've argued that the money, that is the penalties, they go to National Revenue Institute. When you are of the view that part of those penalties must be used for various reasons, that is the development of that particular industry, and you are citing this case of this example of agro-processing. But you said in your submission that this was never accepted by Treasury. Now, here's my question. Do you know why Treasury rejected this, you know, package and this proposal you're making? That's the first one. Now, let's move to blocking measures and the issue of national security. You have also here proposing in your submissions that Section 18A of the Competition Act be removed completely from the bill and be considered as a self-standing legislation on its own, and the cluster dealing with national security to deal with that. Now, be that as it may, here is my problem. Because further down in your submissions, you are then in the same section, argue that you are bringing alternative arguments to say, if then we keep Section 18 and then these are your amendments. So
So can I take it that, here's my problem. What would be your best price? Are you arguing as a lawyer here and say, in the main, this is what I stand for, that Section 18 must be completely removed. If I lose that argument, alternatively, this is an argument. I just want you to because I know you come from that background, being a legal practitioner, so would it be a case of I argue in the main and then alternatively? And then let's move quickly now to your alternative argument. I am struggling with your alternative arguments because... No. I'm moving to the buying power. Yeah, let's go to the buying power, the issue of unfairness. Now, that's my third question. The issue of unfairness, you argue that it would be difficult to really give a definition of what is unfair because it's broad, it's vague, it's absurd. I take that point, and then, again, be that as it may, you are making your own proposal, which in my view remains vague as well, because you are saying here your proposal is that we must use the phrase impending ability of such suppliers in the applicable market to participate. My question is, what do you mean by, for instance, if I argue to you and say impending the ability, what do you mean by ability? Market to participate. What is participate? I'll make an example. One, would you say someone is already participating in the market? Let's say in the gold, let's say in the mining, I am the supplier of safety gear, but I want to grow and supply technology in that space as well. So I'm already participating in a very small way, but I want to grow. So the issue of, the applicable market to participate, my participation, how do you measure my participation? And how do you measure my abilities? So we are dealing with this vague concepts, and you are also bringing your own suggestion, but I find it vague. Now, here is my point. If this legislation were to be given a day, would you think that our courts will help us when this legislation is brought before court and to be subjected to the scrutiny of our courts, we will develop enough legal jurisprudence and then legal precedents, and our case law will evolve to address these issues. Because even what you are giving to me, I will still argue that it becomes vague. And this is what we are grappling with. We know where we want to go, but we say it's not an easy road as we deal with this Competition Act. So don't you think if this act is allowed or this act passes this process and becomes law, then we could hope that our courts, we can have comfort that our courts, when these matters are brought before them, give us sufficient legal precedence and case law. Even the issues of the burden of proof or the evidentiary burden that you are raising, those concerns, I just want to ask you again, those concerns will be the concerns that will be addressed to courts when these matters are brought before courts through litigation to clear these areas. And I'm just checking with you, because you also suggest that some pieces of this legislation must be removed, some must be kept, and then you argue alternatively. So maybe if you could clear for me what would be your really first prize in all this, whether you are arguing under, a blocking of measures or any other argument you have raised in your submissions. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. Yes, thanks for the presentation. I think I also want to just agree with my colleague here on the one side, and the one specific thing was when Minister Patel came to present the bill to us, I specifically asked him about the South African economic situation at this moment, where we really want business partners from other countries to actually come into this country to do business with us. And why would they come to us if we make it more difficult for them? They would rather go to other emerging markets and we actually compete against. So then this is for that same reason why I'm asking what my colleague's asking, would it not be better then rather than to scrap Section 18A, as this will become a very complicated situation and actually will hurt our country's economy if we go on with Section 18A.
on a legal ground. Now, maybe I don't know, as my colleague was asking, which one would be the first prize on that. Then on the situation which we deliberated on unfairness and fairness, I must agree with that because it does not prove a negative. It's just as well as I'm saying morally it's wrong or morally, because what's morally wrong to you might be morally right to me. Is very vague. Should it not be that it actually gets totally excluded? Because I see what the problem is on this, on unfairness, because what might be fair to you might not be fair to me. And to determine that is a catch-22, whichever way you're going to go. So I don't know, should one not perhaps take that out? Then the last one on guidelines. I fully agree with you, but should one not go when we talk about guidelines? And I think, Chairperson, we had this in a few committee meetings over the past few years where it comes on guidelines must and guidelines may. And I think it should just be wording when you talk about guidelines that you may, because you cannot have guidelines must. And I fully agree, a regulation is not a guideline. So one must determine where you're going to go do regulations or guidelines. And when you talk about guidelines, I think instead of must, maybe just say may. You may follow the guidelines. And what your views on that? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me, Mr. Kutzer, welcome the presentation. I always like it when we get you legal minds, because unlike the trade unions and the business partners, your interest is not as subjective as what theirs are. My first question would be, I'll use the 29 pages that you presented, because I worked from there. Now, on page 2 there, you are acknowledging the opportunity of making your submission in person, but then you also indicated to us who you consulted with. Now, did I hear you properly that you say, A part, that you consulted with advocates as well, and not just with attorneys? The second part of that same question is, why was it that you have not consulted with stakeholders in the social sector, like, for example, civil society organizations or groups like that, or have you consulted with them? Because I'm coming back to that again when I look at some of the amendments that you are proposing. My second point, Chair, is there is this reference that you are making to Pioneer Foods and the penalties, and then also the National Revenue Fund. Now, you would know, as a lawyer, that part of the discourse that's happening in our country at the moment is related to the overreach of courts and also the constitutional division between the three arms of the state. Now, in terms of the proposals that you are making with regard to the National Revenue Fund and who should actually be responsible for the appropriation of the penalties, don't you think that it is appropriate that that should rest with the Treasury? Because the Treasury is constitutionally the government structure that is responsible for the appropriation of revenue generated by government. So that's the second question. My third one, Chair, relates to the buyer power provisions. That part of the point that you're raising there about the unfair prices is that my brother, who's running an SME, rightly complains
then why should he pay, and you use the example of water, why should he pay more for water than what Macro pays for that same water? And if we look at the price difference, it is huge. And the difficulty that we're having at the moment, looking at the global economic reality, is that it is SMEs that are a major contributor towards inclusive economic growth. And if we are introducing this legislation to help position our country in that international economic arena where we recognize the role of SMEs, would you still say it's unfair? My third question, Chair, is related to the National Security Review. Now, I've raised it with Kasat earlier on, but would also want to raise that with you, sir. That you say that security is widely defined, and I concur wholeheartedly with you on that. But then, where are we sitting with at the moment with the international competitiveness is a very difficult space for the developing world. I do participate in meetings of the World Trade Organization, just to give you two examples. Last year, Africa went to the ministerial conference in Buenos Aires because we wanted Africa and our agricultural sector to be taken seriously. There was no agreement. And we are talking about competitiveness in this space where the continental needs of Africa, I don't want to use the word competitiveness or demands, the needs of our people in the continent are not appropriately addressed in that space. And therefore, there's nothing wrong with us as a sovereign state looking at the international interest and also our national security and saying that an element of that security is for people to be given security by the state, the right to access to food and to fight hunger and poverty. If we introduce legislation to mitigate that international reality, is there anything wrong with it? But also in the WTO, sir, what happened was that there was a forum meeting that happened last month in Geneva. And in the forum meeting, we've had a lot of civil society organizations. And a lot of what is contained in this bill that is before us came from the 2,700 participants from civil society organizations that were there and saying how they, as emerging entrepreneurs, are struggling to make an inroad into the market economy. Now, where we are sitting, and we're unapologetic about that, is that as the ruling party, we're saying that we support the free market. But we are saying that even the free market is not free. We can't have that dominance of a small sector. And that is what this legislation is meant to achieve. It's not meant to do away with the free market, but to say that we can't have the monopolies that we have in that market. But in the same vein, we are also saying that it's important that we bring the SMEs into that. You made reference to the OECDs, but my question, therefore, Chair, is have you also looked at the dynamics within the WTO and negotiations happening there?
and to what extent is that informing the proposals for amendments that you are making to this legislation before us. My next point, Chair, would just be to say that it is important for us to recognize that when you say other players in government have not been consulted, and you're mentioning international relations, trade and industry, tourism. Now, all members of this committee is sitting in another select committee where we deal with those three departments of government. Not that they have made presentations to us, but I'm saying that don't you think that the conversation and the deliberations that has happened in the cabinet has actually allowed the executive members within those departments to give their input on the matter? Just the final point related to that as well is that when we look at how our structures of government work, we have an economics cluster, and those within the economics cluster have indeed looked at this. My B part of that final question then is just related to the Department of Trade and Industry in particular, where there ought to be, and I can safely say that there is indeed close collaboration between the two members of the executive, the Minister Ibrahim Patel and the Minister Rob Davis. Would it be fair to request you to say whether you are of the opinion that that engagement is not enough for this bill that is before us? Do we need to consult more rigorously? Which is an unfair question, because you don't know how rigorous the consultation has been. But if you read the legislation, does it give you that impression that that consultation has not been rigorous enough? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Ntebe?
Chair, I'm going to try to be short, but I want to draw a picture. The amendment bill in the main 62 two things. Deal with the over-concentration of the economy. Secondly, the skewed pattern of accumulation, distribution, and production. And you started by saying you agree in the main with the objects of the bill. But you seem to be concentrating around your Section 18A, which you've done excellently well in saying this is going to be our proposed amendments if the committee accedes to your amendments. But I wanna draw a picture, because later on you then came back and said there must be continuous promotion of free market system. I'm not quoting you verbatim, but I'm just thinking that you said it was gonna be very difficult to determine that SMMEs or cooperatives are not even small business, and therefore somebody who's running a business, how do you determine the level of fairness? Now, my question, does your organization believe that this is a monopolized economy that we're living in, and it is dominated and run by oligarchies? If yes, second part of the question is, how do your organization seek to deal with the skewed pattern of accumulation, distribution, and production? How do you open up for SMMEs and cooperatives to be also participants in the same economy without necessarily watering down competition? I'm a firm believer that if we are going to leave the current status quo as it is, then I need to determine, for instance, let me be practical. You can go to whatever big, say, manufacturing distributor. There's a contractor's chief. And if you compare the prices at the contractor's chief and your normal customers in a separate custom, in a separate chill point, they are not the same. They are not. Contractors are getting prices lower than the actual consumers who do not have money as opposed to contractors. But also your slides go back and said, in the remedial part of it, and said, more often than not, when the Competition Commission takes a decision, whether it's about anything that impacts on consumers, the actual consumers do not feel the essence of the actual decision. So I would have thought that from your organization you would have said, what are the means and ways of trying to say, now that these are people who are the real sufferers of the same consequences, how do the decision impact on them positively this time, not negative? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Just some few points from me. Oh, okay.
Final request, sorry, that I skipped it. The presentation that you have made to us today, could you tell us what's different in terms of what you have submitted to the National Assembly so that it just helps us focus on what we need to look at? Thank you, Chair.
I think perhaps some of the points that he was referring to were the amendments that were made by the Portfolio Committee. So I think he's also talking to those. I'm sure their presentation was more focusing on the original bill from the department. And then when the Portfolio Committee made some proposals, so maybe that's what motivated them to also come again to the Select Committee so that they deal with those amendments that were made by the Portfolio Committee, such as the guidelines. In the original bill, it talks about guidelines, but then the Portfolio Committee changed the guidelines to regulations. So they felt that they need to make submissions with regard to such changes. I'm not responding on their behalf, but let me just say some few observations from it. You were saying in your opening remarks that Honourable Ntembe correctly puts it, that you support the object of the bill, but also you commended the work that is done by Competition Commission. And then you said, even though you've had sometimes crossed swords with them, and just on that point, I take it therefore that when you say you cross swords with them, it means that you have also represented those that the Competition Commission is taking them to task, where most of the time will be big business, meaning that are slightly different from Honorable Makwe, when he says that because you from legal fraternity, therefore your input will be neutral or objective. I disagree in the sense that you also represent a big business, so you might be also taking their views in terms of this particular bill. That's the point that I just wanted to make. But also with regard to the issue of regulation, for example, the bill, B-bill from Portfolio Committee, clause 39 of that bill, when it refers to the issue of regulations, it says, the following section is hereby substituted for section 78 of the Principal Act. One, the minister, by notice in the Gazette, may make regulations that are required to give effect to the purpose of this act. Before making the regulations referred to in section 4, 5, 8, and 9, the minister must consult the Competition Commission
and publish a notice in the Gazette, A, stating that draft regulations have been prepared, B, specifying the place which may include a website where a copy of the draft regulation may be obtained, C, inviting interested parties to submit written comments on the draft regulations within a reasonable period, and D, consider any comments submitted within the period contemplated in paragraph C. So my question, therefore, is that the issues that I know you, in terms of your submission, there are various areas in terms of the sections that you refer to, but when I look at your presentation, most of them are around section 4, 5, 8, and 9, except the one that deals with section 18. But most of them are around these four sections, 4, 5, 8, and 9. Don't you think those issues then for will be covered in the regulations, but also you will be given an opportunity to make comments on those regulations, including points that you raised about how buying issues of unfairness will be perhaps clarified in the regulations themselves. So those are the points that I wanted to make. Can I go back to you so that you can then respond to the question from the memo? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members, for these questions. Normally the lawyers get to ask the questions to the witnesses and fry the witnesses in the witness box, so the table seems to have been turned. But I'm very happy to try and address all of your questions. I want to start maybe with the Chair's question about the Law Society of South Africa's standing, in a sense, to make these comments. On the contrary, we do not here represent only the views of big business. The Law Society, as I've indicated, is a representative body for all attorneys, including attorneys that act for big business, for small businesses, for the commission on occasion, and for and for even the economic development department. So I think you must see us not as waving the flag for a particular constituency. The flag that we are waving is for the legislation to work, to do its job, to seek to obtain its objectives in the most efficient and the best and the quickest way, and for the commission to be continue to independently enforce the legislation for the best benefit of market players and the markets generally and the welfare of consumers and the citizens in general. So I don't think that you could say that our comments were only influenced by the considerations of big business, although some of our members also represent them. Then it's important, therefore, also to say that we fully share the objectives of the bill. And as was indicated by the honourable members, economic exclusion and the need to transform the economy is indeed something that we appreciate is a high on the agenda, and it needs to be addressed. And therefore, we have not attacked the bill and said none of those provisions ought to be in the bill and it must just be excised from the bill on an entire basis. And quite to the contrary, what we have done is to say, let us rather look at those provisions and see to temper them and to surgically work on them so that they can work more effectively to do what they are intended to do, and not to drag us down into years and years of litigation. And secondly, also to make sure that the parties that must both enforce the law but also must be obedient to the law, i.e. the firms, can know exactly what they need to do. So it's, on the contrary, it's not going against the objectives of the Act. We very much appreciate and share the view that the Act should, or the Competition Amendment Bill should seek to address those objectives. So if I can then address some of the specific questions. So the first question is related to the Pioneer case as to why the Treasury blocked that. Unfortunately, I was not at the case myself, but my understanding is that they felt that the penalties should come directly to the National Revenue Fund, because that's the only section in the Act that talks about the national revenue the penalties. It says actually the fine should go to the National Revenue Fund. And again, we do not have a difficulty with that. We do not say that the penalty should go elsewhere. That section should remain in the Act, and the penalties that are levied for deterrence purposes should go to National Treasury to determine where they can be best applied. What we are suggesting that there is also a role, an additional role, a supplementary role, for a portion of the funds that are paid by the contraveners of the Act to be deposited into a fund that can do more direct, or has a more direct benefit to the people that have suffered as a result, and also those market sector, and particularly seeking to achieve exactly the objectives of the Competition Amendment Bill, to promote small businesses and businesses run by historically disadvantaged communities, which have difficulty to get funding, which have difficulty to get training in business processes and the like. And that is what the Agro-Processing Fund has done, and the Supplier Development Fund. So by no means are we saying that all the penalties should be simply be taken away from the state and be redirected. That's definitely not what we are suggesting. Then with regard to Section 18A, Honourable Member, indeed our first prize, if you can put it that way, is indeed for it to be located in a different piece of legislation. But what we are suggesting is preceded by that is to go through a proper consideration process, maybe a white paper, both in the UK and in the US. They are looking at their own legislation in that regard and reviewing it and seeing, you know, how can they improve that. And all we are suggesting, it's a very complex area, and it feels just to us that it is introduced into a piece of legislation where it doesn't belong, and it has been done very much on a rushed basis. Now, with regard to the consultation, I unfortunately cannot say much about the government consultative processes and the parliamentary consultative processes. The points are well made and taken. We are just focused on the explanatory memorandum to the Act that said that only the economic clusters and the employment clusters were consulted. If the other clusters were consulted, then so well and so good, and then it perhaps ought to be pointed out in the explanatory memorandum. We are just pointing out it's a very complex area with counterbalancing measures. You're balancing, in a sense, the protection of South Africa's citizens against national threats and instability and the like, against chasing away foreign direct investment. And we think that our first prize, if you like, is that ought to be considered a little bit further in a different piece of legislation where a broader consultation process can take place. But if in true legal form, if we don't get the first prize, if the committee and the department is not prepared to remove it from the bill at this stage, then we say at the very least there should be reconsideration of the broadness and the far reach of that legislation and the benchmark that doesn't appear there. So that's in a sense our alternative argument, or our second prize, if you like. Then on the question of buyer power, so the question was whether our suggestion of the alternative benchmark is also not vague, and that refers to the question of the ability to participate in the market. I've got two answers to that, and the first one is the word participate has been defined in the Competition Amendment Bill, and it is defined as follows. It says participate refers to the ability of or opportunity for firms to sustain themselves in the market, and participation has a corresponding meaning. So I think that is at least, I agree with it, it's not a wonderful solution, but it's at least a better solution than the question of simply unfairness, because there is a test. The test will be, will that small firm, will that historically disadvantaged firm be able to sustain himself, herself in the market if he or she had to pay these prices? You know, the differential prices that you referred to, paid by your brother for water against the prices, or the prices that the contractor have to pay. Will it be able to sustain itself against macro and game or whatever in the market? That, to us, seems to be a better test than the test for unfairness, where one has to prove that you are not acting unfairly. Then the second answer to that is this very term is already in the Competition Amendment Bill. And that is in the proposed Section 9. If you look at Section 9.4b, where it talks about the relevant factors in benchmark determining whether a dominant firm's action is price discrimination that impedes the participation of small and medium businesses and firms controlled or owned by historically disadvantaged persons. Sorry, it's also in Section 9A, Roman numeral 2. If I can direct the committee, it's on page 5 of the Competition Amendment Bill, and you'll see it under Article 6B. So the price discrimination is then, if it's likely to have the effect of impeding the ability of SMMEs and HDP firms to participate effectively. So it's already there. That's why we're saying, if you're going to have it there, why don't you also have it in the buyer power provision? Why do we have to live with this vague concept of unfairness? And yes, it is indeed so, as was suggested, that the courts may work it out. You know, I can only say the term excessive pricing in 19 years of competition legislation, which is potentially a more precise term, the courts didn't work it out. Or if they had worked it out, this legislature still felt the need to define more precisely in this Competition Amendment Bill what excessiveness means. And there is now in section, the new section 8A, or is it in the definition, five or six factors which says exactly what it means. So what we are submitting to this committee is that rather than again stumbling into another set of litigation and things that will be caught up in the courts for many, many years, is to just replace it with another benchmark that's already in the legislation in Section 9. And that motivates our reason for that. And of course, I do agree that the courts are very helpful, and we appreciate and support the independence of the courts more generally. If you could just allow me a minute to see whether I've addressed all the other queries that were raised. With regard to the consultation, maybe because we're in the legal fraternity and as competition practitioners, we work with advocates and expert economists, we got their views as well. The point is well taken that we also perhaps should have more specifically engaged with civil society organizations. Again, our members represent a broad group of clients, including civil society organizations, and I note that the civil society organizations have made comments on the bill more generally, but yes, we perhaps did not have enough time to also engage more broadly with such organizations. Yes, with regard to the point about the WTO and the international competitiveness for South Africa, again, that is why I think one honourable member suggested maybe we should just scrap Section 18A altogether and throw it out. We're not suggesting that at all. We think there may be a need for South Africa to protect itself against national security threats. You won't find any debate with us there. Our debate is, how far is that piece of legislation? Should it be as wide as it is at the moment, worded to encompass virtually every economic endeavor? Or should it more narrowly drafted? But also, should it not really be, such as in other countries in the world, be part of a separate piece of legislation that is looked at by... There's a number of things that were pointed out in our written submissions where it shows about the conflicts. Now, the competition tribunal must decide on the penalties, for instance, if a person doesn't notify this National Security Committee of a merger. And now, so the problem is that you're going to get conflicting demands because the competition authorities look at competitiveness of markets, of domestic markets. This national security looks at an entirely different thing. So we think that it doesn't fit well in this piece of legislation, and that's why we suggest it. But very much so because all of those international trade obligations and generally that whole area should be looked into more deeply is why we suggest that it ought to be removed from the existing bill. We did not look particularly at the WTO when we put our comments together under great haste, I should add. I finally think that I should just say a word about... I think the question was whether our submissions here are different to the National Assembly submissions. What we focused on today were mainly on those sections of the Competition Amendment Bill that were brought about by the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee. So those are new provisions. For the most part, in our written submissions, we have repeated some of the things in the National Assembly Bill that were not addressed and that we thought was worth repeating. And then on Section 18A, we made the same submissions as we made to the National Assembly, but we just fleshed it out a little bit more and gave more precise proposals of how the subsections could be fixed if Parliament is minded to approve the bill or to keep Section 18A in the bill. Chair, if you can just allow me 1 minute, I just want to check with my colleague whether I've missed out anything. Thank you, Chair. I think my colleague just points out that I've not specifically addressed the issue of whether our organization believes that the markets are monopolistic generally and whether these remedies are necessary. So I think that there's been a lot of research by the Competition Commission in this area. We are not economists, so we have not looked at the research. There are other people that have made submissions to Parliament, both at the National Assembly level and here, which I think may potentially address it. We assume that that is the case. We assume, and that's why I've said before, we support the objectives of the bill, and if the objectives are to address economic exclusion and the lack of transformation in markets and the fact that there are many firms with dominant positions that are capable of abusing those positions, that those things need to be addressed, we say yes, they ought to be addressed, but if you address them, please let us have a piece of legislation that is like a sharp instrument that can go to the heart of the matter and address them perfectly. And therefore also we say with regard to penalties, if you can save a portion of the penalties to go back into addressing the issues of consumers and smaller firms that were harmed as a result of the anti-competitive conduct by market players. But in principle, the Competition Act is about a free market which if the free market goes off the rails and goes into abusive positions and anti-competitive conduct, that is something that needs to be curtailed, and we are fully supportive of that. Thank you, Chair. I think that addresses all the questions.
Thank you very much for the presentation and also responses to the questions from members. I think you were here when I was outlining the process to the previous presenter, that we will be getting the responses to your submission from the department. But then at some stage, in terms of our program, we will then consider your input or your presentation, but also consider the input of the department in response to your input, and then we'll deliberate on those, and then take a position independently as a committee on this particular bill. Thank you very much for coming, and also coming here than associated.
Thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I think those were the two submissions for today. The challenging situation that we find ourselves now is that some presenters or submitters pulled out. We had scheduled this whole day up until 1900 hours to deal with the public inputs. Now it puts pressure on our program for tomorrow. We thought we could have done as much as possible today, but some then pulled out. There was a program that was drafted that was sent to me by the committee secretary. Having looked at that program, I then decided that we should go until 7 so that we do as much as possible today, because tomorrow we only have half a day. Remember that there's another select committee tomorrow. Then immediately after that meeting, we then continue with the public hearings. But tomorrow there are much more presentations. Today we took 3 hours just on two presentations. Tomorrow there are about 7. And in our discussion with the chair of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations, we hope to start at 11:30 tomorrow after the committee.
we will go on until we finish with all the presentation, all the 7 presentations, no matter how long they take, even if we leave at 12 midnight tomorrow. Now we come to a situation where we have a free afternoon, because also we don't have a plenary this afternoon. We've got all the time, but unfortunately those who are going to make presentations are only available tomorrow. So I just wanted to clarify that, Honorable Makum.
If the presenters tomorrow have to compete for time, we will apply the Competitions Act in terms of limiting the time that we give them for press, because we have been reasonable by saying come Wednesday and Tuesday. And if they prefer to come only Wednesday, it's tough competition.
Yeah, no, definitely we stick to time tomorrow. So we've been very generous this morning, because we only have 2 presenters, but tomorrow we'll have to stick to time. 15 minutes for presentation, 15 minutes for questions and clarities and responses. Honorable Margot.
Thank you very much. I just want to suggest that, is it possible we can start earlier? I know it's scheduled to start at 10. I'm asking this at the backdrop of some of us. Look, we're only 4 members today, and tomorrow I promise you, you'll be less, because some of us are serving in the Constitutional Review Committee. I'll be rushing there at 2 o'clock, and tomorrow we're pushing until 7. Tomorrow is the same story, because we need to deal with the report that is tabled. But I would want to be present, and I'm just saying, if we can start early, because I know we all rock up 8, you know, in the morning, so I don't know. I leave it in your capable hands here.
You know, it won't be possible, as I was indicating, that Wednesdays are meetings of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations. I think the chair is generous by saying that we start with the public hearings at 11, meaning that he's going to push the meeting faster tomorrow to accommodate this committee, so that immediately after that committee, then the public hearings start. I know I forgot to mention that there are 2 apologies that we received, that of Honorable Dekhale, as well as Honorable Matevula. Honorable Mteto, as you know, that he is hopping between 2 committees, COCTA and our 2 committees here. So the COCTA Select Committee on top, or COCTA is in KZN. They're dealing with Section 139 of the Constitution, one of the municipalities there. That is going to be under administration. So they're only coming back tomorrow evening, so that they are part of the plenary on Thursday. So just wanted to clarify that situation. So we have now a free afternoon, unfortunately. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. I think there's that, if I'm not mistaken.